This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Being a vegan means not eating or using any animal products. It's usually seen as a choice of diet, but for Laura Wright, it's also an important choice of identity. Her new book is called The Vegan Studies Project, Food, Animals, and Gender in the Age of Terror. From politics to pop culture, the book examines how vegans and vegetarians are represented in American society. Laura Wright discusses her book at Malaprop's bookstore in Asheville on Friday at 7 o'clock, but first joins me from member station WCQS in Asheville. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about this concept and where the concept comes from. It's not just about being a vegan or recommendations for a vegan diet. This is a much deeper project. Tell us about it.
Yeah, thanks. It isn't. I'm afraid people will think it's a cookbook on at first glance. So it came about in large part because I am vegan and have been for a very long time and just had been really interested in the difficulties of that identity and engaging with friends of mine or family, and then also being really interested in depictions of veganism and vegetarianism more generally in the news, on television shows, in film, in books. And I think the sort of the thing that really sparked my desire to write the book was an article by a guy named Harold Frum that was published in the Chronicle of Higher Education in 2010 called Vegans and the Quest for Purity. That was pretty scathing. And I just really wanted to look at why the anger, why the sort of presuppositions about people who've made this choice.
Well, tell us more about those suppositions and, again, some of the challenges that you confront as you meet people who aren't family members, et cetera, some of those initial challenges that got you interested in this.
Sure. I think, you know, food is such a big part of one's, well, it's a huge part of one's life. It's also a big part of one's culture and one's tradition and heritage. And so, you know, choosing to eat in a way that is different from the way one has been raised is always kind of a confrontation. So I had to deal with that with my own family. I think my father's still sort of waiting for me to outgrow it. He referred to it as a phase I was going through one time, but since I'm 45, I don't think that that's going to happen. But I think that, you know, sort of the idea is that you're not getting enough protein. Mm. You're just entirely too precious. You love animals too much. You eat bark. You're a tree hugger. If you're a man, you're not very manly. And also this kind of idea that there's some sort of moral superiority that vegans seem to have that, you know, they're willing to sort of lord over people who have not made that decision. So that's, I think it kind of comes from just a rejection of things that feel really normal and good within our culture.
So let's talk about that in that Chronicles of Higher Education piece, this quest for purity, this idea that in some ways vegans are lording over us a kind of purity. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, I think this. I read an article in The Onion the other day that was the tagline was "Vegan dares to order meal without meat in front of non-vegan friends," and I think it's just the idea that in making this choice, one is always sort of calling on other people to recognize that their choice is different, and it's not a conscious thing, but. It's not an intentional thing either, but I think, again, because most vegans make this decision from an ethical place, that other people then think about their own ethics and their own choices.
And it can be threatening at that point. So it's a certain extent, you know, sort of how you felt might have something to do with the way that individual came across, and it might have an awful lot to do with just how you perceived it and the challenge to your own ethical choices. But talk about these identity issues. I mean, it goes beyond just diet choices and whether or not it's healthy. It really has become a label that has associated many characteristics that become connected with it.
Right. Well, I think, in terms of identity, it's not just about what one eats. It's also about what one wears, what one chooses to do in terms of participating, like whether you go to the fair or not, because you maybe can't deal with the animal situation that's there or the circus or any number of other things. So it's, I think it is a big kind of identity in terms of the fact that you're choosing so many things that are that seem very antithetical to what is normal in our society. I think it does go beyond just saying I'm not going to eat animal products into kind of everything else. And one of the things I was thinking about on the way over here was that it is virtually impossible to find anything that doesn't have dairy in it somehow.
Right.
So just, you know, wanting to get a snack somewhere and having to think about the complexity of then having to look at the label of every single thing that's out there to find a snack.
Well, I do want to talk about the challenges and sort of an American dietary choices and how things have changed. But I want to stick with this identity question for a minute because it has become so gendered. I mean, the idea that that men don't, you know, I mean, if I want to talk about your masculinity, I can use the word vegan to one way or another create an association, right?
Yeah, definitely. And there's a great book called The Sexual Politics of Meat by a woman named Carol Adams, who's actually going to be reading with me on Friday. And she wrote the foreword for my book. And she talks a lot about the fact that food has, in all cultures at all times, been gendered in really specific ways. And in our culture, meat is definitely associated with masculinity and with strength. And the idea that, you know, men would not eat meat is something that is really, really complex and troubling and calls into question one's masculinity, definitely.
And it gets played out over and over again. We've got a clip from a Burger King commercial. This one, 2006, The Manthem. Let's listen.
Okay.
I am man, hear me roar. And numbers too big to ignore. And I'm way too hungry to settle for chick food. 'Cause my stomach's starting to growl. And I'm going on the prowl for a Texas double whopper. Man, that's good. Oh, yes, I'm a guy. I'll admit I've been fed quiche. Way tofu, bye-bye. Now it's the whopper beef I reach. I will eat this meat till my innie turns into an owie. I am starved. I am incorrigible. Stop a big burger, beef, bacon, jalapeno, good thing down.
Well, you get the idea. That's Burger King's Manthem commercial. Now, here's the thing. I mean, when you're doing commercials, they're not pushing social policy here. They're following.
Right.
So clearly there is a trend that they have found and they want to capitalize. That's already in the culture, right?
Right. Well, and I think, you know, there's a lot of things going on in that advertisement. I write a lot about that advertisement because it's just so fascinating to me. But I think, you know, there's this sort of pushback against women's independence, against, you know, eating like a woman, and also against, you know, anything that's sort of not perceived as American. The food that guy is eating at the beginning clearly looks like it's European, it's French or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's like this whole confluence of things that get lumped in there, femininity, meat, the other, you know, culturally.
Right.
So even though it was filmed in Brazil, by the way, with Brazilians pretending to be American, which I absolutely love.
Love that. Well, but that also gets us, I mean, it's a tangent, but I think related in many ways, which is one of the ways of coping with the anxieties that are endemic in American culture. So if what it means to be a man and the roles of masculinity are a challenge, the answer from the culture is buy something and eat something.
Right.
It isn't really explore what masculinity is and your relationship with women. That's off the table. Buy a hamburger and you will prove, and that should allay any of your fears about who you are. So the commodification of this is sort of another part of the issue.
Yes.
And you've also said that I'll let you talk about that in a second if you want to include that in an answer about the meat in the post 9/11 era and meat's association with patriotism as well.
Right. Yeah. So when I was writing the book, that was kind of a moment. There are a lot of things that happened that kind of crystallized 9/11 around the sort of change I think that we experience culturally with regard to many, many things. And one of them was food. So, you know, if I can kind of talk for just a second about sort of the things that were happening in the 80s and 90s that kind of led up to September 11th in terms of the way we think about animals and food. It was actually, those were really good decades for a kind of consciousness about eating differently. PETA was founded in the 1980s and did lots of really graphic stuff showing people that their food had a face. Sales of beef slumped during that time. Ethnic food became really popular. John Robbins wrote Diet for a New America in 1987, and he linked eating meat with environmental destruction. So there was all this stuff happening in 1991. The four food groups were challenged, and meat and dairy were actually taken out of the sort of food pyramid that we had. They were put back in after a lot of pressure from the meat and dairy industry. But all these things were kind of happening that were really positive in terms of thinking differently about eating. And then when 9/11 happened, we kind of found ourselves in this place where the rhetoric was very much about a kind of us and them. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. And that played out in lots of different ways. And I think the ones that I'm really interested in are someone like Anthony Bourdain calling vegetarians terrorists in 2007. In 2008, the FBI started monitoring protest groups by sending people undercover to vegan potlucks. And into 2009, police in the UK started flagging travelers on flights if they chose a vegan diet. Mm. So I think, you know, there kind of became this discourse that if you were not eating like an American, which meant eating meat and eating things that were, you know, comforting, I actually understand a lot of the kind of slipping back into that, you know, meat and potatoes kind of eating. But everything that wasn't the norm suddenly became really suspect, not just weird, really scary.
Well, and you've also looked at the ways in which veganism is reflected in popular culture. In the first chapter of your book, you write about vampires and veganism. Tell us more about that.
That was the first chapter I wrote. It was, and I kind of just wrote it for fun, and then it just became, I became really interested in it. I think vampires are really fascinating figures because they always represent the things in our society that we are trying to repress or that we're afraid of. And this is the case with Dracula, sort of the one that everybody knows. In the Victorian period, the fear of women's sexuality, the fear of the non-British other, Dracula is not British. And so he, you know, kind of is all of those things, and he gets challenged, and he of course gets killed ultimately. But I was really looking at our current vampires, the ones that we have on television and in film. I looked at Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which is one of my favorite shows from the 90s, has characters that don't eat humans, they eat other animals. And I looked at Twilight, because if you're an English professor, you can't really get away from the fact that your female students are all going to be reading Twilight, or at least when it was out, they were. And those vampires actually refer to themselves as vegetarians because they don't eat meat, they eat animals, which is exactly what a vegetarian isn't. And then I guess lastly, I looked at True Blood, which was the HBO adaptation of Charlene Harris's Southern vampire narratives, and was really interested in the fact that those vampires are eating something that's synthetic. So they're not eating people and they're not eating animals. They're actually vegan. So I, you know, I was kind of thinking, like, what does all of this mean that we suddenly have these vampires who are doing things that are, I think, good? Like, they have souls. They're ethical. What does it mean that our society is casting those things in shadow?
They're the other. They're the thing that we're afraid of. Well, that gets back to the ideology question and whether other ideology can stand as an indictment if I were forced to examine my practices that I just don't want to give up. To what extent is veganism an ideology, and does it, and is it something that's, you know, is there an apostolic mission to preach veganism as a way of being?
I don't think so. I think that I would, you know, I think it's more aligned with anarchy than anything. I looked a lot at this in the book too, trying to figure out, you know, is there a vegan identity? Is there a vegan mission? And there are organizations that are vegan specific, but I think because vegans are nonconformist in this particular way, they also tend to be nonconformist in most other ways. And as a result of that, they don't tend to be parts of sort of codified movements, if that makes sense. So I don't, you know, I have never felt like, and I know there are vegans out there who really want to, you know, change your mind and make you feel the way they do. I would love that, but that has never been my goal. My goal, you know, has always just been that this is my decision and I'm able to make it from a place of a lot of privilege that I don't expect other people to have or to embrace. So, yeah, in some ways I feel like it's a religion for mm-hmm. me, but I don't think there's an ideology that's driving it to cause other people to convert.
You also talk about the paradox. I mean, I think if there is a theory, if one comes to veganism because of the sense of doing little harm or reducing a footprint or some kind of ideological revelation to that individual, you talk about the paradox. I think Joseph Campbell said that the vegetarian fails to hear the scream of the carrot.
And I think you
handle this in your book, right?
Yeah, that's Tristan Stewart talks about this. He has a book called The Bloodless Revolution, which is a really comprehensive history of vegetarianism, although he doesn't say a whole lot about veganism. But the sort of challenge is that, you know, vegetarians and vegans are trying not to cause harm when in fact there's no way not to cause harm. You're caught up in the cycle of life and death and you can't get out of it. So that, and yeah, this, the cry of the carrot, I've had more people say, well, plants have feelings too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I kind of think Carol Adams has this term retrograde humanism, which is that, you know, you have to, if you can't, you can't do everything and therefore is the solution that you don't do anything. And so I get that you can't do everything and you're not going to be able to save the carrot necessarily, but does that mean that you shouldn't try and save the sheep or the cow or the pig?
And certainly reduce your impact in a lot of ways.
Sure.
Laura Wright, what a pleasure. Good to talk with you.
Yeah, thank you. Nice to talk to you as well.
Laura Wright's new book is called The Vegan Studies Project, Food, Animals, and Gender in the Age of Terror. She'll talk about the book this Friday, 7 o'clock, Malaprops in Asheville. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.